Clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell. Zing, zing, zing went my heartstrings. From the moment I saw him, I fell.
Meet Me in St. Louis is the tender, romantic story of the most popular young beauty of the early 1900s, of her crush on the boy next door, of her lovable, yet at times humorous family,
everybody. Welcome back to the Film and Water Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I am, of course, your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this week to talk about 1944's Meet Me in St. Louis, one of the great Hollywood musicals from the Hollywood's Golden Age, is writer and podcaster and longtime listener, Kevin Lauderdale. Kevin, thank you for doing the show.
Pleased to be here. This looks like a lot of fun, but wait a minute, is it St. Louis or is it St. Louis?
You know, they sing it, Meet Me in St. Louis. I guess it's easier for the rhyme.
That is the rhyme. A lot of people know, of course, the chorus to, you know, Meet Me in St. Louis, Louis, Meet Me at the Fair. But remember, it's a song, and there's a verse that begins, if I may be allowed to render it in the best sense of the word render.
This Go right ahead.
1904, so I think it's pod safe. I think we're in the public domain. When Louis came home to the flat, he hung up his coat and his hat. He gazed all around, but no wifey he found. He said, "Where can Flossie be at?" A note on the table he spied. He read it just once, and he cried. It ran, "Louis, dear, it's too slow for me here, so I think I will go for a ride." Now, Meet Me in St. Louis, Louis. So that second Louis is the guy's name. You're not just repeating it. It's not like it's Meet Me in Los Angeles, Angeles. But that would actually work for episode of Buffy, wouldn't it? Or actually Angel. So it is Louis because that second Louis in the chorus is the guy's name. It's an epistolatory song. But I also usually just say St. Louis as well.
So. You have a very nice singing voice, Kevin. I enjoyed that, actually.
There's something like 27 different verses to the song, actually, on Wikipedia. I won't do them all.
If you don't like this song, if you don't like the song Meet Me in St. Louis, you should not watch this movie because you hear it a lot.
That's right.
Throughout this movie's two-hour running time. For anyone who hasn't seen it, this is directed by Vincent Minnelli. It stars Judy Garland in one of her sort of signature performances, and Margaret O'Brien, Mary Astor, Marjorie Main and Lucy Bremer and Tom Drake and Henry Davenport, June Lockhart, and one of my all-time favorites, Leon Ames, as the father. The film is basically, it's a year in the life of the Smith family. It takes place the year before the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair, and the four Smith daughters learn lessons of life and love, even as they prepare for a reluctant move to New York. Kevin, what makes this movie so great? And it is so great, but what makes it so great?
A whole bunch of stuff. First, there's the stuff you can appreciate when you're younger, and then there's the stuff you can appreciate when you get to be our age. So first of all, the songs are all fantastic. They were written by a team of Martin and Blaine, and such standards as the Trolley Song, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, The Boy Next Door. It's funny. The humor really holds up. My daughters and I watched this for the first time in several years, and they were laughing out loud. We had previously watched another MGM musical, Good News, wherein the humor does not hold up at all. I'm very sorry. Sorry about that. It is beautiful to look at. Oh, my God. The attention to detail in the sets, the clothes, the gorgeous technicolor, the nostalgia. This is one of those better, simpler times that everybody always longs for. And, it's so nice and mellow. And, you know, a lot of people complain this is a movie in which not a whole lot happens, but the things that do happen are nice and relaxing. Then, when you get to be my age, you look at this and you say, yeah, this is a nice, shiny MGM musical, but it's also an MGM musical that subverts bright, shiny MGM musicals a million times. There's a prolonged Halloween sequence, which is actually kind of spooky.
We would get to that. Scene is better scary stuff than a lot of horror movies I've seen.
And so that's like maybe a third of the movie or a little bit less. It has no music. It has no song. There's the musical without a song in that sequence. There's, as we'll talk about later on, a sort of watered-down minstrel scene wherein the music that is used completely undercuts the minstrelsy of the dance. It's got a classic Christmas song, which features the most depressing lyrics of any Christmas song ever.
We'll have to muddle through somehow.
Yeah, one of the original lines was, "Have yourself a merry little Christmas, it may be your last." So you can watch it when you're younger, and even when you're older, and enjoy all the wonderful shiny surface stuff. But there's also a lot of strange stuff going on underneath, which makes it even more enjoyable when you get older. There's something for everyone.
Yeah, I was relatively unfamiliar with this movie for many, many years until I saw A Personal Journey with Martin Scorsese, that long-form documentary that he did where it's like something like 5 hours long, and he's just telling you about, you know, movies that meant a lot to him and movies that he think really advanced the art form. And he has a scene from this movie in that documentary, and it's the scene where little Tootie, which is the youngest of the Smith daughters, played by Margaret O'Brien, and Tootie, the original goth girl, absolutely.
Oh my God, that's actually, she's got to be the model for Wednesday Addams.
Yeah, I mean, she is absolutely, I mean, she's talking about her little Dolly has four fatal diseases, and it only takes one, and when they talk about later that they all have to move, and she's like, I got to dig my dollies up out of the graveyard. You're like, what is this chick, you know? And then she wants to pull a prank where she's going to derail a train. Like, she's a troublemaker. But anyway, the scene in Scorsese's documentary is of Tootie, where she is so upset over the idea that they're going to move from St. Louis to New York that she runs outside and smashes all of the snowmen that have been made to look like her family. And it is it's a very dark scene. And I remembered, you know, I had heard of this movie. It was a musical, and I was of the age. I'm like, I don't want to watch that. It's a bunch of old-timey things, and there's people in frilly overcoats. It just didn't seem like my kind of movie. But that scene in the Scorsese documentary, we go, this looks really interesting, you know? And then I eventually went and found it, and I was like, oh, of course. Now I get it, because it's one of the greatest movies ever made. Of course Martin Scorsese would put it. It's absolutely brilliant. And yeah, in terms of the look, this thing, every scene looks like something from a postcard. It is just so sumptuous to look at. And it's funny, Vincent Minnelli isn't, I don't know, I feel like he's not as remembered nowadays as some, older directors. But man, that guy made a lot of great films, and a lot of them were really just completely stunning to look at. I mean, this thing is just, it's just beautiful.
The author of before there was a musical, it was a book. Before it was a book, it was a series of vignettes in The New Yorker. And the author, Sally Smith Benson, these were sort of autobiographical sketches, was actually on the set. And Minnelli wanted her to, like, provide some input. So what you're seeing is, I'm sure it's a slightly amplified version, but it's more or less what her house looked like when she was growing up in St. Louis. So she lived in a nice upper middle class. Is he a stockbroker?
He's a lawyer.
He's a lawyer. It looks like a mansion to me, man. I mean, I know lawyers do pretty well, but the girls sort of portray themselves as, like, middle class or upper middle class, but I think they're probably the 1% of St. Louis. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous set.
Yeah, he must be making some serious coin, because I said the house is gorgeous. He's got five kids, because there's four daughters and the son, and then the grandfather lives with them, and then the mother lives, you know, doesn't work, and then there's also a housekeeper.
Yep. Mrs. Brady, you know, beforehand, you can stay home by yourself. But also, everybody had a maid back then, and especially if it's Marjorie Maine. Like, oh my God, who wouldn't want her as your maid? She's so full of one-liners.
One of the things that is, well, there's a bunch of stories about how this movie got made in terms of the interesting things. One of the more sort of memorable ones, or the one that carries with the film, is that Judy Garland did not want to do this movie. She was 21 at the time, and she didn't want to play a teenager, and she just was not had nothing to want anything to do with this movie. And it was Vincent Minnelli, who of course eventually went on to become her husband, hence Liza Minnelli.
Yep.
Convinced her to do it, and he worked with a costume designer that worked at MGM to make Judy as beautiful as she was ever going to look, because apparently she was always made to feel very insecure by the studio. They put false teeth on her and they stuck things up her nose to give her a different profile, and they were always complaining about her weight, and she was very, very timorous. And Vincent Minnelli just thought, you're a star, what are you talking about? And later on, apparently as they started watching the dailies, Judy Garland realized, this is the most beautiful I've ever looked on screen, and it probably is.
She looks absolutely gorgeous. I mean, not just gorgeous, but also sexy. If you're used to Judy Garland as Dorothy or as Betsy Booth in the Andy Hardy movies prior to that, she is a grown-up woman here. Yeah, a lot of people the script was passed around, and Judy Garland was like, great, I don't want to play. You know, haven't I been the teenage girlfriend before? Also, people who read the script sort of warned her against it, saying, you know, whoever plays Tootie is going to steal the screen from you. Well, eventually, even Arthur Freed, who had produced it and produced a bunch of musicals for MGM, was starting to feel a little hesitant about this. And he gave the script to his secretary, who was his most trusted reader. And he said, should we even do this? And she read it and she said, yes, it's about family. And that's important. And we have to remember, this was made in 1943. So we're in the middle of World War II.
Right.
It's far from a foregone conclusion that we're going to win. And this is one of those movies. It became a massive hit. And I'm certain one of the reasons it became a massive hit was not just the costumes and the songs. It was the idea of family. This is what we are fighting for. You know, what are we fighting for? We're fighting for family and a world wherein the toughest decision a 19-year-old boy has to make is, who do I take to the Christmas dance? Not, how am I going to kill those Nazis over across that hill over there in France? A lot of people think, oh, well, this is such a quiet movie. I mean, not a whole lot happens. But it's a celebration of family and the small dramas. There's no jewel thieves in this movie. There's no bombs going off. It's a quiet, homey musical. It's a celebration of home and family. I think that really appealed to wartime audiences and continues to appeal to all of us.
Yeah, I mean, when Esther's betrothed, John Truett, the boy that lives next door, he can't get his tuxedo back from the store in time to go to the big dance. Esther wants to kill herself. She's just completely besotted, you know. And you're like, for a typical teenage girl, yeah, it's the end of the world. But yeah, you're mentioning of the context of when this film was made. Yeah, that is really important. I mean, yeah, if you watch it, it really is just sort of a series of vignettes, and there doesn't seem to be a whole through line exactly. But then you think, yeah, but you've got Judy singing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, and you talk about, you know, we'll have to muddle through somehow. And you're like, that's a very powerful song to be overseas and to hear. You know, I mean, there's a reason that song was such a massive hit. And, you know, the film works outside of that context, but when you remember it in that, you're like, yeah, that must have been enormously powerful to see these people. And you're like, yeah, that was what life could have been like or was like not that long ago. And like, as you said, I'm worried about getting killed by some Nazi, and these girls are worried about finding a right boyfriend or, you know, that kind of thing. It's nostalgia, but it's sort of wonderful nostalgia.
If you want to reinforce an idea, it's always easier to reinforce the past than the present or the future. I'm just looking quickly here on Wikipedia. Oh, my God. I think every single song has something to do with family. There's Meet Me in St. Louis, Louis, about the husband and the wife. Boy Next Door, that's the I Want song, which is about meeting a boy. Under the Bamboo Tree, which we'll get to later, is a song about two people meeting and one proposing to the other. Over the Banister is a love song. The Trolley Song is about meeting somebody and falling in love. You and I is about an older couple together.
That's my favorite song in the whole movie, is You and I.
Great, great song. And that's Arthur Freed himself singing that
song. That's right, 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 yep. Right.
Lang Syne. You know, and of course, finally, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, which is all about, you know, things are going to be really tough, but we're going to be together.
It's it's sort of amazing when you think that all these songs are written for the movie, and like, you know, God, these guys were on a roll. You know, I mean, yep. Every one of these is sort of, and it reminds me a little of bunch of years ago when the Coen brothers released Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And in one of the interviews they gave about the movie, they said they wanted to reflect a time when music was made by everybody. It was it was made by people, regular people, and it wasn't just for professionals. It was, you know, everybody sang because that's what you did. After you didn't watch television, you sat around the piano and you sang songs. And this is a very musical family. They're performing little songs together, and yet they're not musicians. These are not professionals. I mean, as we said, the father's a lawyer and the mother's the housewife, but they're all very talented and very musical, and that's, again, reflecting a time of when that's what you did. The regular people engaged in singing and performing as opposed to just being a specialty thing.
That's one of the great things about this. Part of this, a subset of the nostalgia, is seeing specifically how things were done back then. Forget there being no television or radios. There were no recording devices. You went to a store, you bought sheet music, and then when you went to a party, you brought your sheet music and your instruments, and everybody had fun that way.
The Under the Bamboo Tree song that, that you talk about, that they sing, Tootie sings. And there's a whole bit where Tootie sings a song about being drunk, which is very scandalous for a little girl to be singing about. I was drunk, dear mother, and stuff like that. And, you know, she is a rip. I mean, great as Judy Garland is in this movie, Margaret O'Brien as Tootie is really quite the little scene stealer, because she just gets stuff that it really would have been amazing to hear in 1944 a little kid say.
Most of the best lines in the film are from the book, which means they more or less happened to Sally Bentha. She herself is Tootie in the book, so all the great stuff that's there is given to her. One of the great things about this film is its lush Technicolor. I like to play a drinking game called Look for the Red. They loved their red spikes. It's not just red backgrounds. It's look for the red milk jug on the dinner table, the slash of red on Judy Garland's dressing gown. During the Halloween sequence, look for red wheels on a horse cart in the background. There is red everywhere.
Yeah, you know, the Halloween scene, we should mention that. Because
let's go into some detail about that.
Yeah,
sure.
The Halloween scene, there's this long sequence of where Tootie and the older sister, I forget the older sister's name.
Agnes,
go out for Halloween. Now, this is a time, this movie takes place in 1903. This was before candy was part of Halloween. Halloween was going out and basically playing tricks on people and being kind of like little young vandals, really. Mm-hmm. It was purposely shot by Vincent Minnelli to be scary. The camera was placed down low on the ground, so the houses look looming and very scary. And as you said, there's no musical number in this scene, and it's Tootie goes to get get revenge on a neighbor who she says he likes to murder cats, which, of course, you know, Tootie's making up most of the stuff that she says on the spot. And she throws sugar at him.
It's flour.
The flour, I'm sorry.
It's flour, because if you wet the flour a little bit, it makes it even harder to get it off their faces.
So she opens the door, and it's just some regular guy, and he's got his bulldog. You know, and she's like, I hate you, Mr. Whatever. And she throws the flour in her face and runs off. And then later, they set fire to a bunch of stuff.
That's what Halloween was. It was only after World War II when, you know, sugar shortages ended and people really became obsessed with children and delinquency and things like that, that Halloween got tamed. This is what, you know, our American variation on the ancient Celtic rites were like. This is, you know, when people would pile up stuff in the middle of the road and set it on fire, that's the Wicker Man.
I didn't think you would be able to get the Wicker Man.
Wicker Man and Meet Me in St. Louis. That was my crossover. When you know, people came from Ireland and England, they brought all of these old sort of Celtic traditions and stuff like this. This was scaring away the ghosts. This was pretending to be something you aren't. This is back when Halloween was the thin wall between the living and the dead. And it was celebrated by all this vandalism. Somebody says, I'm going to take my hammock, I'll fold it up, it'll be on the porch. When you steal my hammock, just be sure you bring it back afterward. Yeah. If you listen to old-time radio shows from the 30s and 40s, Halloween is about – there's one, like, it's the Aldridge family, where they're going to try to remove somebody's front porch. It was all about these low-level acts of vandalism, and is only post-war when things got sort of domesticated that we converted it into something else.
Yeah, you find out later on when Tootie supposedly comes, she goes back with a bloody lip, and she supposedly John Truitt did it to her. Of course, we find out that isn't true. But we learn that she and Agnes had made a dummy, and they were going to throw it on the train tracks, and the plan was for the train to derail.
They really
what?
they they really get into the spirit of things. That whole scene, I think the reason she lies and says John tried to kill him is I think she is totally caught up in the fantasy of that Halloween universe where she really is, you know, a horrid drunken ghost or a hobo or whatever it is. And she believes when you throw flour at somebody and say, I kill you, I murder you, it actually does it. She's totally enraptured in this fantasy life that she has of, like you said, being goth where everything is death and it's very heavy.
Yeah, I mean, and as good as Tootie is, I do want to mention Agnes does get a couple good lines. And when I just watched the movie again in preparation for this, and there was a line that she has that I completely missed, and it's near the end of the film, and it takes place on the last night of the movie, which is Christmas Eve, and Agnes comes into her sister's room, played by the oldest sister, Rose, played by Lucille Bremer, and she says, I want to open up a Christmas presents or something. She goes, isn't it Christmas? And Rose says, oh, you just want to find out what your presents are. And Agnes says, I hope somebody got me a hunting knife. What? And they just move on.
it's par for the course. When the doctor comes in to look at Tootie, he's like, what is it this time? It's like, did she break something? What bones has she broken?
Yeah, oh, yeah, the doctor is more, yeah, he's had his sort of fill. He's very sweet to her, but he knows that she's incredibly rambunctious. So.
And that's another sort of subversion is these are not the usual sweet girls you see in an MGM musical. They have this bloodthirsty comical streak, which I guess is all just part of their fantasy life, part of their life of the imagination. Again, something we had a lot more of back at the turn of the 20th century than today, because you had to make your own adventure. You had to make your own drama and your own excitement.
Yeah. I mean, again, it goes back to the musical part of it. I mean, you had to go and entertain yourself, and yep. So you were naturally going to be quite good as a performer. I mean, for Esther to be a, I said she's not a professional singer. She sings like Judy Garland. I mean, she acts and performs like Judy Garland. I mean, it's about as good as anybody ever did it. And the numbers they put on are incredibly well choreographed and, you know, really, you know, beautifully staged and everything. It's like, well, these are all just amateurs doing this. But again, that is part of the sort of Hollywood magic part of it, that you buy that.
So let me jump back to Under the Bamboo Tree, which I alluded to, which is a really interesting scene for me. So it's the adult, older children are having a party, and they're performing for themselves. The teenagers are performing. And Esther's friend of Esther says, oh, look, Miss Esther, there are mice in the house. And Tootie and Agnes, the two younger, come down, and they want to be part of the celebration. They want to be part of the party. And Tootie says, you know, I can do the cakewalk if Esther does it with me, which was sort of a low-level minstrel bit. And for those of you who are just still too young, minstrelsy was basically white people and black people putting on blackface and performing what we now recognize to be insulting, stereotypical variations on black culture and black song. So actually, it's a good thing it's not like a full-scale black, because that number would have been cut when it was on television. I saw Holiday Inn a million times when I was a kid, but I wasn't until I was in college, I saw it on Turner Classic Movies, that I realized there was an Abraham Lincoln's birthday.
Oh, right, yes.
It's in blackface. It was always cut on television, so I'm glad they didn't do that. But still, what they're doing is the cakewalk, which was a highly stylized part of that. But here's the thing. I love the fact that the song they are doing it to, Under the Bamboo Tree, was written by the black men who completely changed black music at the turn of the century. It was written by Robert Cole and the Johnson Brothers, and there were three black men. They had their own sort of black theatrical team, and really prior to their coming on the scene, everything in black theater minstrelsy was Mammy, the Watermelon, Down the Plantation. They completely blew that up. They made songs about the common people, not on the plantation, but just living life in the city. They made this particular song is about royalty. It's about a royal maid of dusky shade. They introduced sophisticated lyrics. They introduced sophisticated rhyme schemes. Oh, my God. One of the lyrics here is, if you love me like I love you, we love both the same. I'd like to say this very day, I'd like to change your name. What an incredibly sophisticated way of saying I want to marry you. Mm. That would not be out of place in a Cole Porter song 20 or 30 years later. So these guys came along, completely changed black music. And so what I want to know is, who chose this particular song? Say, oh, well, we're going to have Esther and Tootie do a sort of low-level minstrel number. Do we just pick something from 1903? Or do we pick something more sophisticated? I would not be surprised if Arthur Freed chose this song. I don't know who chose it. Arthur Freed, the producer, himself had been a songwriter back in the 20s and 30s. In fact, I think every song in Singing in the Rain was written by Arthur Freed, like 20 or 30 years earlier. So the one scene that's even slightly potentially offensive is completely undercut by making the music in the scene by the black man who totally changed black music at the time. So I love that.
That's amazing. I didn't know any of that. That's remarkable. That's very interesting. Yeah, so well, this movie, it does – I mean, that's why it's so – you know, it's managed to sort of last and become so famous, is that it does have that extra level of complexity to it. I mean, one other another thing that I love about this, this movie is the married couple, the mother and the father. Played by, as we mentioned, Leon Ames and Mary Astor. Of course, Mary Astor is from Maltese Falcon just a couple of years previous. But, you know, I love the fact that these two characters, they are A, completely believable as a couple. They have a really great chemistry. And they are given a couple of scenes where we get to see what they are like as a couple, as a man and a woman, not just parents. Mm-hmm. You know, in most movies and, of course, in life, it's hard for anyone to think of their parents as existing before you did. You know, you're like, did my parents have lives before I came along? Well, of course they did. Yeah. But it's hard to make that. And they have a couple of really beautiful scenes. And, you know, I mentioned briefly at the top how much I love Leon Ames. I was not familiar with him before this movie. I am in love with this guy now. Like, I want to hunt down the other movies this guy has been in, because he is so funny and so good as the harried put upon father. I mean, whether it's from the beginning where he can't get the meal that he wants to get, because all the daughters have connived to end the meal sooner. That way, when the erstwhile boyfriend calls, the father will be out of the room and he's frustrated. I mean, he's worked all day at the law office. He just wants to get his pork chop or whatever it is, and the maid keeps cleaning him up before he gets to finish it. And then near the end of the film, where he comes and he says, "We're all going to move to New York. I'm a big wig at the law firm, and we're going to move." And the family does not take it well. And he is at first really put upon, because he's like, "I'm the one making the money here. You girls like to spend money. Mm-hmm. I got to make it somehow." But he's so warm and so sweet. And there is after everyone's gone to bed, and then this is Christmas Eve, and everybody's upset. And he sings a song with his wife, and that's the "You and I" song, which you mentioned earlier. And that is, first of all, it's beautiful. It's just a beautiful song. And you mentioned Arthur Freed is the one singing it, not Leon Ames. But for a movie that's 2 hours, it's not like it runs long, but it allows that breathing room to sort of watch these two start to, you know, Mary Astor starts playing on the piano and he joins in. And initially she's playing it at a different key because he's trying to sing it higher. And she's like, "That's not your key." And then she plays it down. And it's just a really beautiful little moment of, despite the fact that this movie is all about the daughters and all of their travails, we're going to spend this few couple of minutes with these two. And we're going to see that they're a real couple. They're really in love. They love each other. And you see why they've produced this wonderful family. And to me, it's really very touching. It's really very beautiful. And there's another moment later on after, spoiler alert, the father finally decides, "We're not going to move to New York. We're going to stay here." And he gives a whole speech. By the way, I love movies that end with speeches. Whether it's Psycho or Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. I love movies that end with one character just talking for like 2-3 minutes.
But I think he just topped me bringing Psycho.
There we go. Well, you get The Wicker Man was pretty good. So he does this whole speech about, you know, well, St. Louis is one. He acts as though that they're the ones who want to move to New York. And he's like, "But, you know, this, we're living in a paradise. You don't see it." And after everybody opens the Christmas presents and everybody's happy because they're not moving, the mother walks to the foreground. And she's partly underlit a little, and she's crying because she's so happy. And the father comes up behind her and just gently puts his hand over hers, like it's on the piano or something. And again, it's really very beautiful. And I just – there aren't a lot of movies that I think portray married couples in a positive light. You know, it's either the romance leading up to a marriage or – you know, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, if we're going to throw in all kinds of crazy references. But you know what I mean? It's either the lead up or trouble. But here, these are just two older people. They're in their 50s, and they still love each other very much. And it's probably my favorite. It's, again, You and Me is my favorite song in the movie. But it's become my favorite part of the whole movie, is that those their dynamic. They have a really good chemistry.
This is a film such the characters are so nice. You'd love to spend time with them. I'm not going to say they're all super nice, but they're such refreshing characters compared to especially the stuff we see today. It's great to have these little character moments. It just, again, if you could go back in time, if you could go into a film, this would be a wonderful universe to inhabit. And these characters would be so much fun to spend time with. They're so nice. They're so sweet. They're so caring.
Yeah, I mean, like when Esther can't when her boyfriend can't go with her to the ball, the grandfather offers to take it because he's got a tux.
Yeah,
you know, and it's really rich. And there's a wonderful moment too. Again, you're talking about that extra level of that it's got going on, but we see Esther and Rose get ready for this ball, and Esther has to put on this the corset. And there's a whole long sequence where it really does look like Julie Garland's rib cage is being crushed. And she's walking around like, and you're like, just that little bit of a behind the scenes kind of detail where, of course, in a thousand other movies, you'd see everybody in these amazingly frilly costumes. But here you get to see what these poor girls did to look nice. And there's one point where they're like, I think Rose has practically got her leg up against Esther's back as she's pulling the strings in to get her to, and it's like, again, it's like, I don't think you've ever got to see stuff like that in a lot of other musicals.
It's another one of those slices of life, that the nostalgia slices that we see that you don't usually get to see how things were done. We completely forget how things were done. There's a scene earlier where they're walking around, they're dimming all the lights, and all the lights are gas. And they have this big, long pole to reach up for the chandelier.
The early selfie sticks.
Exactly. Like, oh, so that's how they did it. It's like, I've been wondering about that. This is a historically educational film as well, you might say. You can watch and see how people live. The upper middle class lived.
Yeah. It's funny when they talk about going to New York, and the one daughter says the other daughter, like, well, I think that's where rich people live in New York, but we're lower class. We're going to have to live in one of those slums or something.
Yeah. It's like where are we going to live? We'll live in a house. Rich people live in houses. We have to live in a tenement.
A tenement, that's right. By the way, you mentioned that scene with the gas lighting. That is, again, it works as like almost an instructional video on how to do this thing.
Yep.
And it's all, I believe it's all one shot.
That's
it's
one
all
shot,
one
yeah.
long shot. And I read some trivia about it. And apparently you can't, in the studio, because this was all done at the studio in the back lot, you couldn't do that with those gas lamps. The studio wasn't built for that. So they faked it by having those lights perched like just off camera range were some Venetian blinds with light being shined through, and as Judy Garland would slowly turn off the gas switch to turn off the light, some camera guy would close the Venetian blind.
Oh, wow.
To reduce the light, and it gave you the effect of the light is being turned off. Now there's okay, so that scene goes on, and then she eventually makes her way up this grand staircase and then turns on one of the gas lamps. And the camera guy had to do the exact opposite thing that he had done earlier in the previous scene, and it was all one shot. And it's again, that kind of like, again, everyone knows how much I love like Orson Welles, and here I am bringing another movie. Citizen Kane has all sorts of shots that call attention to itself. You know, like, wow, look at what I'm doing. Look, there's 10 Charles Foster Kanes in a mirror. Isn't that cool? Yeah. This movie has lots of scenes like that, but they do not call attention to themselves. Vincent Minnelli is much more of a kind of it's subtle, I guess. I mean, when you think about that shot and you're like, wow, that's an amazing sequence we just went through, but you don't really think of it as you're watching it.
Because you're so wrapped up in the characters. The characters are so interesting, and they provide their own low level of drama, but still it's a drama you can relate to. I think that's something interesting is for a movie that takes place now more than 100 years ago, it is a lot to relate to. Things haven't really changed that much on the homey domestic front.
What do you mean?
People are still interested in boyfriends and girlfriends.
Oh,
people are still trying to get to the dance on time. People are still having trouble with their parents. People are still having to move. It's a timelessness to the picture because it doesn't concentrate on the world outside. It concentrates on the world of the family inside, and families haven't changed in probably 10,000 years.
They're all very excited about the World's Fair.
They're also very excited about the World's Fair, which is always fun.
Which I always believe that I have lived in the wrong time, because I love the idea of World's Fairs. I've never been to one because they're not around anymore, and they really were fading out by the time I was young and old enough to have really gone. But I love the concept of it. And so I'm entertained at the idea that the family is so excited about seeing the World's Fair. And of course, that's where the film ends, is at the the St. Louis World's Fair. That's what we get to see, is some of the events and things like that. And it seems all so very exciting.
It would bring the world to you. It was before there was television and airfare and airlines, and, well, not before there were boats, but the world came to you. This is the 100th anniversary of the Louisiana Purchase Exposition. This is celebrating the 100 years of the Louisiana Purchase, and people from all over the world, from Africa, from Asia, came to St. Louis, the middle of America, the World's Fair, and you would go, like, there was something, some immense number, like, is it 14 million people came or something like that, to see over the course of the year or so that it lasted, to come and see what the rest of the world was like. We were still a very provincial nation.
How do you even get 14 million people anywhere before cars?
Trains. I mean, yeah. Everybody came by train. And
oh, we have to, I guess we have to mention train. We have, we glanced by it, but the clang, clang, clang went the trolley song. I mean, I knew it first growing up as the part of the repertoire from the Sweeney Sisters on Saturday Night Live, that Jan Hooks and Noor Dunn used to sing.
Oh,
they always used to sing that song. And I, you know, I knew it was a famous song. It's a real showstopper in this. I mean, and it's also the scene that was done of Judy Garland jumping on this train and singing about the boy that she loves. It is amazing. It is, that is like, when you think of like movie magic, that is movie magic. That sequence is so well put together.
There was, was Judi Dench in a Judy Garland biopic back in 2000?
Oh, Judy Davis. Judy Davis,
excuse me. And I think the two numbers they recreated full scale were Off to See the Wizard and The Trolley Song. Because those are, I guess, two of her most memorable numbers. Oh, it's so gorgeous to see everybody in their outfits. And again, it's a song that advances the plot, talking about meeting a boy, falling in love. But it, clever lyrics, clever syncopation, gorgeous colors everywhere.
I never get tired of that rear screen projection. I can look at that all day. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like, and I don't know if it's just because it's old timey, but, and I know it's fake, but I just love it. I love looking at that combination of doing the thing on the set, but then having that rear projection. I just find that utterly charming. You said the colors in that scene. I mean, the whole movie, as we've talked about, is beautiful to look at, but the costuming in that scene is just unbelievable. It really is.
It's the rear projection reminds me, it's the handcraftedness. It's like why people still enjoy seeing Ray Bradbury's stop motion animation as opposed to, you know, the super smooth CGI now. There's a handcraftedness to this film that really comes out.
It is sort of amazing when you think about, like, what, you know, why can't they make movies like this? Why is it so expensive when they could do it back then, when they had to do everything by hand and they were able to do this? I mean, I guess probably the costumes and the sets for me, some of those are probably used for 20 other B pictures after they were done with this. I guess that was probably part of the cost effectiveness of it. You're like, well, we build these things, but then we can use them for the next Ma and Pa Kettle movie where they, you know, where they meet a bunch of swells or something. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, it's, I was talking to Darnell and Tracy, who I've mentioned on the show before, about when we were watching the movie, like, it's so sad to think that most of these sets were probably destroyed not too long after they were done making this movie. I mean, I know some of the main sets, the streets, were probably on the back lot and used for a lot of their movies, but it's like the artistry of this thing is just so unbelievable, and it's so sad to think that Hollywood didn't put a lot of value on it. You know, they probably, like, once it's done, they're like, wait, we're not. I mean, they apparently flirted with doing a sequel, Meet Me in Manhattan, because in real life they did move to Manhattan, and I guess they were talking about doing that, but it never came off.
Yeah, they had thought about fleshing it out like the Andy Hardy series would be, you know, basically the girl Andy Hardy series with all the girls doing their stuff. But I guess to a certain degree, when you're so popular and so successful, there's some things you can't spin off into a series. Plus, I don't suppose Judy Garland wanted to do it yet again.
Yeah, I mean, she was certainly very happy. I'm sure that she did this movie because, A, she met her future husband, Vincent Minnelli, and she said there were quotes from her saying, I never looked more beautiful. Mm-hmm. There's another quote, apparently, where you mentioned about that nobody wanted to do this movie, and it was Arthur Freed and Vincent Minnelli that pushed it, and apparently, after she saw the first couple of scenes, she said to Arthur Freed, don't let me ever tell you what kind of movie to make again, Arthur. You know, I thought that's great. She recognized, no, this thing is really, really good. And she went off. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, we went to see A Star Is Born on the big screen. And it's tragic when you sort of see that there's only 10 years difference between this film and Star Is Born. And Judy Garland looks like she's aged 30 years. I mean, she looks, but she is luminous here. And you said it's interesting that Vincent Minnelli saw something in her that even the studio didn't see, like a sort of radiant beauty that they didn't. They were like, "Oh, you're fat. You got weird teeth. You got a weird nose. You're kind of dumpy." And he looked at her as like this goddess, you know. And it, as good as everybody else looks in this movie, and again, Leon Ames, I just think he looks like J. Jonah Jameson, which is what I love. But I mean, she looks. I mean, you talk about the red lipstick mm-hmm. that she's got. I mean, she really just, she just pops right off the screen.
Peaches and cream complexion. Sometimes the red that they put in there is just her lips against the beauty of her face.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of that is, how much of that is love? How much of that is the magic of love? Was he falling in love with her as they were filming it? And so that framed the way he shot her and framed her? I don't know.
Yeah, he really knew how to use colors. I've seen a couple of his other musicals. He did the Bandwagon, and the Bandwagon has a musical sequence, an extended musical sequence in the middle that is like a, looks like a tribute to pulp novels. And man, it looks like Dick Tracy. I mean, I was like, this is one of those guys that I just never appreciated growing up. I never really heard of him. And now I'm like, boy, if Vincent Minnelli directed a movie, odds are I want to see it because it's probably going to be pretty good. You know, even his lesser ones. I'm like, still, it's just really, really talented guy. Do you have a particular, before we wrap up, do you have like a particular favorite musical number of the ones we talked about or even ones that we didn't talk about?
I like them all, which is sort of a cop out. I really enjoy the energy of the trolley song. I enjoy the sentiment of you and I together forever. I even enjoy the depressing aspects of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, because it's like the Charlie Brown thing wherein, you know, it's a holiday. It's supposed to be fantastic. It's supposed to be great. Well, it's also the end of a year. People are, you know, people pass on. People go away, sometimes just to New York. Sometimes they die. Lots of stuff happens, and everybody tends to overemphasize the positive aspects of holidays, but there's some dark stuff. It can be depressing, as they say in When Harry Met Sally. You know, just try to make it from the day after Thanksgiving to the day before Thanksgiving to the day after New Year's, you know, a lot of suicides.
Oh, yeah, I mean, when Tootie smashes the snowman representing her family,
yeah.
I mean, really, it's like, that's a pretty, and boy, is it lit beautifully. I mean, these dark blues, when she comes running out of the house, there's all this sort of orange light on her from behind. But man, when she's out there, it's like these deep, rich blacks and these nice blues and these whites, and really, and said she's just smashing the heads off of her family members.
Are you familiar? I'm sorry, go ahead, finish up.
And just, and the way she cries, like mm-hmm. she really cries. It's not fake kid crying. It is ugly crying. It is, you know, like it is. You, no matter what you do, you cannot console this kid because she's so upset. She's going to lose everything that she knows in St. Louis.
So do you know? Are you familiar with, you said you didn't know this film all that well. Are you familiar with the urban legend concerning how Minnelli got Margaret O'Brien to cry?
Supposedly, but I'm sure anyone who's listening does not. So what is this horrible story?
So, for a long time, there was this urban legend, and I finally did, you know, some reading and some following up on interviews and things like that, and I pieced it together. The urban legend is Minnelli went up to her and said, you know, I've got bad news, Margaret. You know, your dog was, like, hit by a car, and he's gonna die, and I'm really sorry. But okay, and film the scene. But actually, Margaret O'Brien was a really good crier. That was one of her selling points. And another good crier was the slightly older June Allison. And supposedly Margaret O'Brien's mother, when Margaret had to cry for a film, would say, "You know, you don't want to have June Allison topping you. You can do it. You can really perform." When this scene was being filmed, Mrs. O'Brien said to Vincent Minnelli, "Okay, she can cry in command, but." And we need you to go up there and you need to sort of like prime the pump. You need to just, you know, tell her something. Tell her like her dog has been run over. Her dog is going to get killed or something like that. And that will really prime the pump. And Vincent Minnelli said, "I don't want to do that. That's gross. That's terrible. I'm not going to do that." And Mrs. O'Brien said, "No, it's how she works. So
it's her process.
It's her process." So Vincent Minnelli went up there. He said, "Okay, Margaret, I got bad news. Your dog has been kidnapped and he's going to get killed." Margaret O'Brien was like, "Okay, is there going to be a lot of blood?" He's like, "Yeah, it's going to be really blood. It's going to be a lot of blood." Margaret O'Brien was like, "Okay, I got it. Let's go." So, yes, Vincent Minnelli did go up to Margaret O'Brien and say horrible things about her dog, but he wasn't trying to sell it. He wasn't trying to make it believable. It was, as you said, Margaret O'Brien's process. It's the world's most messed up, what's my motivation?
That is, oof. And Dustin Hoffman thinks he's committed.
Exactly. So she went out there, and yeah, she put everything she had into that. She actually got an honorary Oscar for, like, you know, a year or two's worth of crying, if you will, of, you know, portrayal of juveniles and things like that. So she really sells it. And as you say, people warned Judy Garland, whoever plays Tootie is going to steal the show, and Margaret O'Brien steals the show. And that is the scene I think most people, if they've only seen this film once, really remember, is when Margaret O'Brien just loses it and destroys the end of the Christmas sequence is her just destroying these snowmen. I keep thinking of Calvin and Hobbes doing horrible things to snowmen.
Oh, yeah, right. The snowman car accident and stuff like that. Yeah, yep. Yeah. The other story that I had heard about, again, related to Tootie, which this film is kind of dark, was that they wanted to get Margaret O'Brien for the film, and then she wanted more money, or her family, of course, wanted more money. And so the studio was like, well, maybe we're not going to get Margaret O'Brien. So they hired another actress, and it was the young daughter of the lighting technician, or one of the lighting guys. And then they have ended up getting Margaret O'Brien, and so they let the young girl go, of the daughter of the lighting guy. And then apparently someday during the making or during camera testing, that same lighting guy accidentally dropped a lighting rig near Margaret O'Brien.
Oh my God.
And it almost killed her.
Oh my God.
And apparently he was then not only relieved of his duties, he was apparently sent to a mental hospital later on or something because they found it. So, you know, anyone who listens to this show, they know how much I go on and on about, like, the golden age of Hollywood. And, like, I feel like that, you know, I'm born in the wrong time. And, boy, there's some dark stuff, though, from that period of time, you know. I like to think everybody just got along, and it was like, let's just go kill Hitler. But, yeah, you know, there was some pretty dark stuff going on in the hills of Hollywood. But anyway, it all ends up on the screen. That's what's important, is what ends up on the screen. I said this movie is an utter masterpiece. It is really beautiful. It's probably I don't have a whole lot of, like, favorite Judy Garland movies because I'm just not that huge of a fan in particular. But this is certainly my favorite of hers. This is, I think, my favorite performance of hers, even above Wizard of Oz. And again, it's just so beautiful to look at. The music's terrific. The performances are terrific. Martin Scorsese, as usual, completely right. This thing is gorgeous, and it's a masterpiece. And if you haven't seen it, you should absolutely track it down. And for anybody that wants to do a deep dive, Warner Brothers put this out, and they did this was back when DVDs were still making money, and they put effort into these. They did, like, a double disc version, and it has all this extra stuff and, like, missing scenes and a commentary, and there's an intro by Liza Minnelli. They really did a nice job. It's like, if it's the kind of movie you end up liking, you'll love it that much more by buying the disc, because it just gives you everything you would want for this movie. So it's just utterly terrific.
I have that. Yeah, it is fantastic. This is a musical for people who think they don't like musicals, because it's not exactly the integrated musical where people suddenly come to a stop and start singing, although there is some of that. But the singing is low-key. The singing is – it's classical singing. In a sense, every song in this movie has become a standard, a classic. If you think you don't like musicals, kick back on a holiday. Watch this with your family.
Absolutely. And ultimately, you know, it's about enjoying what you have in front of you, and sometimes that's a good lesson, you know, mm-hmm. to learn. So that is Meet Me in St. Louis. Kevin, thank you so much for doing the show, man. I really appreciate you. This was one of those ones that, like, I don't know if I ever thought I would find somebody to talk to about this, you know, and then you mentioned it. I thought, oh, this will be perfect, because it's something that I did want to get to. So thank you for doing the show.
My pleasure. I really had a great time.
Awesome. Where can people find you on the internets?
I'm not quite a Luddite, but KevinLauderdale.livejournal.com, at least okay. It's not on my MySpace page, is where
GeoCities.org.
where I occasionally put stuff up. But also, I'm on two podcasts, which are on the Chronic Rift Network, chronicrift.com, and, of course, on iTunes. And that's a whole network of podcasts. My two are Presenting the Transcription Feature, which is an old-time radio podcast where I usually bring in a radio comedy and a radio drama or a quiz show, and I present them in their entirety along with some annotations beforehand. So when there's going to be a reference to Joe DiMaggio, you'll know why that's an important reference, and you'll get some background. So that if you like old-timey stuff, you'll like my old-timey podcast. And the other one is called Temple of Bad, which I do with a couple of friends. And it's about movies that are so bad, they're practically a religious experience. Yes, yet another podcast about bad movies.
There's always room for one more.
There's always room for one more. We seem to, you can so go to chronicrift.com, go to iTunes, check out the Chronic Rift Network, subscribe. You can't miss me.
Very cool, very cool. As always with us, if you want to reach the show, just use the contact page over on our wonderful new site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also use – you can leave a comment on the individual thread for this episode. And, and of course, if you want to follow the show over on Twitter, it's at filmandwaterpod. And I must ask you, if you can remember, please leave us an iTunes review. That will really, really help us out. So, again, Kevin, thanks for doing the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas.
We'll muddle through somehow.
Margaretha, never seen her look so pale.
The sun ought to do her some good.
I expect she won't live through the night. She has four fatal diseases.
And it only takes one.
Take the Earth's mightiest heroes, each an invincible champion of justice, and band them together to assemble the legendary Justice League of America. For 261 issues and 3 annuals, the DC Universe was defended from threats on Earth and beyond by this legendary team. Operating from a cave in Happy Harbor to a satellite orbiting 22,300 miles above the Earth to Detroit, Justice's First Dawn, a classic Justice League of America podcast, will follow the League through all their evolutions. Please join your host, Mike Peacock, as I seek to cover all of the issues of the classic pre-crisis Justice League of America series. Through the magic of the JLA transporter, each issue will be randomized, with special episodes covering a complete story arc if needed. Along with the issue coverage, we shall also look at what the then-current members of the Justice League were up to in solo appearances in other comics for the JLA cover month issue. So do not hesitate to activate your JLA signal device for Justice's First Dawn, a classic Justice League of America podcast on classicjla.podbean.com or by subscribing through iTunes.
Sawate. My name is Stella, and I am the host of Backroll to Oracle, the Barbara Gordon podcast. Backroll to Oracle is a podcast dedicated to Barbara Gordon, the first woman to hold the mantle of Backroll for an extended period of time, roughly 1967 to 1988. The goal of Backroll to Oracle is to examine the character's history from her first appearance as Backroll and continuing through her tenure as Oracle. Each episode looks at a vintage issue of Detective Comics or Batman, as well as other books like Justice League and Freedom Fighters, and modern issues of Batgirl and Birds of Prey. I also keep track of news involving Batgirl and other members of the Bat family, and I have a revolving series of segments like Babs in the Tube, which highlights appearances of Babs in TV and film, Shipper Spotlight, which looks at a variety of comic and pop culture couples, gives their history, and determines whether they are hot or not, Reading with Stella, which could be described as an audio drama, or just me reading a book that relates to Babs or doesn't, and of course, the mainstay literature recommendation. I have been blessed to interview writers Scott Beatty and Chuck Dixon on their Backroll Year One work, Brian Q. Miller on his Backroll run, Dwayne Swierczynski and Christy Marks on their separate Birds of Prey work, and the creators and actors of the Backroll Spoiled, the web series. I hope to interview more creators and actors in the future. My goal, most importantly, is to make a fun, entertaining, and thoughtful show that people enjoy and from which they learn. Find the show online at thebatmanuniverse.net and iTunes, and follow the show on Facebook and Twitter at Batroll to Oracle. Thank you, and fly on, Babs lovers.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to
get ourselves a treat.
Hey everyone, it's time for some listener feedback. So let's go all the way back to episode 40, which is our Treasure of the Sierra Madre episode. Chris Franklin says, I'm embarrassed to say I've never seen this film in its entirety. It was years before I realized the Blazing Saddles badges line came from here. I hate to say it, but most people I know think that line originated with Mel Brooks. I was more familiar with the Bugs Bunny cartoon, but then Bogart's cameos in those shorts did a lot to inform my opinion on him at a young age, from the Penguin short to the one where Elmer Fudd is working at a Hollywood restaurant and Bogey orders a rabbit dinner. No need to apologize, Chris. We're always glad here at the Film and Water Podcast to help inform. And yeah, I mean, I think probably the first time I ever saw Bogey were those Bugs Bunny cartoons as well. If it's rabbit baby once, it's rabbit baby gets. Jeff Nelson says, love this film. It took me a long time to see it, but it was worth the wait. Same with Casablanca. Along with Secret of the Incas, Spy Smasher, Dick Tracy, Mass Marvel, and Uncle Scrooge, it influenced Indiana Jones, the look and the opening locale in Raiders. Absolutely true. Apparently, Indy was in initial stages in the script. Was going to have a drinking problem, which was going to be even more sort of a reflection of the Fritzy Dobbs character, but luckily they took all that out. Jeff continues to say, there is nothing weak about this film. Everything is first rate, and the combination of Bogart and John Huston always produced greatness. One can only imagine if he had been able to do The Man Who Would Be King with Bogey and Clark Gable. He eventually made a classic with Sean Connery and Michael Caine, but Bogey, Cable, and Kipling would have been something. Yeah, that... The mind reels it at a version of The Man Who Would Be King with Humphrey Bogart and Clark Gable. That's, wow. That's just one of those alt-universe movies that hopefully exists somewhere, because that's extraordinary. He also mentions, per comic book fans, check out the Charlton Phantom series, issue number 70, The Mystery of the Molly Ibex. It is one fantastic Bogart riff with characters and scenes that are homages to the Maltese Falcon, Treasure of Sierra Madre, Casablanca, and the African Queen. Don Newton captures the likeness and the mood. It is my favorite Phantom story, both a joy for comics fans and film lovers. That's a great suggestion, Jeff. I love that. I mean, I love Don Newton's work, and he did some great stuff on the Phantom from what I've seen, so I gotta find that on eBay. That sounds terrific, and I will report back once I get it. Chuck Coletta wrote in to say, again, a most enjoyable discussion. The theme of the destructive power of greed has seldom been handled better than in this film. If you like The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, you want to read Frank Norris's novel McTeague from 1899, which is about a dentist whose life spirals into a mix of jealousy, violence, and murder due to his lust for money. I read it in college and never forgot the final image that ends the book. The novel was later turned into the infamous silent film Greed by Eric von Stroheim. Clinton Robbins says, good show, Rob. Glad to know Bogart movies are around for a while. Hoping next week is The African Queen or The Maltese Falcon. Well, unfortunately, Clinton, for you, it wasn't either one of those, but we will get to those eventually. I mean, those are classics, but there's a lot of Bogey worth talking about. And I have some other ones planned, so stay tuned. Paul Hicks from the Waiting for Doom podcast says, great film and pretty dark. I would quibble that, in my opinion, Errol Flynn out-movie stars Bogart. Any plan to look at his works? Well, Paul, we did talk about Adventures of Robin Hood a couple episodes ago, so there is that one. And yeah, there's lots of great Errol Flynn stuff. I still just tend to think of Humphrey Bogart as the ultimate movie star, but of course there are a lot of contenders there. There's Gary Cooper and Errol Flynn and Clark Gable and things like that, so we all can get along. Regarding episode 41, which was The Big Sleep, again, the aforementioned Bogart, Dr. Ann says, when I was submitting my list of films to Rob, I knew I wanted to include at least one Bogey movie. I considered The Big Sleep. But then I became worried that Rob might ask me to explain the plot, and frankly, I can't. And every time it is on TCM, I DVR'd, and every time I say, this time I'll follow it. But usually now we're in, the Gordian knot of this movie's plot becomes too intricate, and I just decide to sit back and enjoy the ride. Yeah, it took me a while to sort of accept that, but now I realize some mystery films are just not meant to be untangled. They just don't care. I found the same similar problem actually with The Nice Guys, which I just saw recently. And about 20 minutes in, I'm like, I don't know what anybody's talking about, so I'm just going to follow this. Anyway, Ange follows up with, but you know movie is special, but Lauren Bacall might not be the most stunning woman in the film. Now, Bacall is otherworldly, beautiful, sultry, mysterious, irresistible. That said, Martha Vickers will melt your eyeballs. She's completely magnetic, just an unbelievably desirable woman. The way she bites your thumb while looking out from under her eyebrows, you know she is poison. That's well said, Ange. She is, she's like a live grenade in that movie. Jeff Nettleton comments, he says, my first Bogey and still one of my favorites is The Caine Mutiny. I saw that on a Saturday afternoon on local TV when I was a preteen and was mesmerized by it. It factored into his history lecture when I was in college where the professor, who had a strange interpretation of the 50s and 60s, offered it as an example of how even film had to uphold authority and the status quo by setting how Jose Ferrer calls out Fred McMurray and the other mutineers on their lack of courage, and he has them acquitted them at the court-martial. Watching the film after serving as a naval officer, I could see that the professor got it all wrong, as Ferrer is attacking them for their cowardice and failures as leaders, especially after Queeg comes to them for help in his own way, which is in itself a powerful scene. Yeah, that's a terrific movie. Another one I'd love to cover, Caine Mutiny. That's a stunning film and features a great performance by Bogart. Chris Franklin, again, of course, from the Supermates podcast, says, Elisha Cook was indeed Kirk's lawyer in the original series Star Trek episode Court Martial. The last thing I remember seeing him in was as a morgue attendant in Blackula. Yes, Blackula. From the Maltese Falcon to the Big Sleep to Blackula. Sigh. Oh, come on, Chris. Blackula, that's a really good movie. Come on. You know what? You're going to be on when we do a Halloween episode. We'll do Blackula. So there you go. You're marked down for that one, Chris. Chuck Aletta says, I just returned from attending the TCM Film Festival. That sigh of jealousy you're hearing from me. Last week, where they screened another very different and good interpretation of Philip Marlowe, The Long Goodbye, director Robert Altman, with Elliot Gould. It's definitely not bogey, but worth checking out. I was there for Alec Baldwin's hour-long interview with Gould, which was recorded for Baldwin's podcast. I hate you, Chuck. Jeff Nettleton says, there's a funny story about Lee Brackett. When George Lucas got in contact with her to write Empire, he asked if she'd written any screenplays. She replied yes, citing Rio Lobo and The Big Sleep. Lucas replied, you're that Lee Brackett? He'd reached out to her because he enjoyed her planetary romances and didn't realize she was one of the screenwriters of one of the seminal noir movies. Ah, the days before IMDb. Siskoid from the Lonely Hearts Romance Comics podcast here on the Fire and Water Network says, the golden age of Hollywood is one of the holes in my cinema knowledge, but you're making me want to fill it in sooner than later. Thank you very much, Siskoid. Regarding episode 42, which was Captain America Civil War with Ryan Daly and Chris Franklin, Ryan Daly himself comments. He says, at around the 1355 mark in the episode, Chris asked what other movie franchises kept the same writer for three movies. I distinctly remember thinking and speaking Godfather, and I was surprised when we recorded that Rob didn't respond to that at all, and Chris just seemed to gloss over like he didn't understand me. Well, now I understand why they reacted that way, because listening to the audio at 1402, it sounds like I said Calchunk or something. What the hell was that? And then Chris Franco responded, I didn't understand you. Ultron took over Skype at that instance. And who created Ultron? Tony frickin' Stark. Yep, Team Cap. Sisko says, the only thing I would take issue with is the comment about Black Panther not having much to do, since I think he was the movie's theme made manifest. And I'm frankly surprised and impressed at how much this was his story. Like Zemo, like Stark, he is out for revenge, but he meets the Iron Man and Cap positions in the middle and manages to resolve what neither other Revenger could. He starts out as a third spoiler element that is on neither side, but through grace and nobility completes his arc. Beautiful. He also mentions Marissa Tomei as Aunt May, controversial casting. It took me off guard at first, but the more I think about it, the more I like it. Not just because I like that actress, but because Spidey is younger too, and while Tomei is by no means a senior, there are more stages of aging than a day away from the hospital. Yeah, that's true. I mean, it makes sense. If you're going to cast a Spider-Man who's 15, his aunt is going to be like about my age. And, you know, that just because you're an aunt doesn't mean you are the old crone that Aunt May was always drawn to. So it makes complete sense. So I'm all for this casting. I like Marissa Tomei too, and I think it makes sense thematically and contextually. Jeff Nettleton says, my only problem with the portrayal of Cap is his strength level. I know it's grown in the comics, but kicking vehicles and holding helicopters down is way beyond what Simon Kirby created, as is jumping out of a high-altitude aircraft without a parachute. He went from peak human ability to superhuman over the course of a decade, and I find it a bit too much. He also went from looking like an acrobat to a steroided wrestler. To me, that was a sign that the writers involved couldn't work out how to use his existing power levels and abilities. I will say that the films have mostly kept that in check. Paul Hicks, again from Waiting from Doom, says, thanks for a great podcast with an overabundance of politeness and deference between the participants. The BVS effect. yes. We purposely didn't want to bring up BVS too much in that show because, you know, we just didn't want to. We're going to open that can of worms again, but you can't help compare the two films. Dale Russell says, this is a personal issue, and I always criticize people for bringing it in, but I can't buy any Baron Zemo character that's not trying to take over the world, because that's what he does in the comics, and that's who he is, and that, is, to me, was extremely disappointing. I did enjoy most of the movie, and the fight scenes were great, except for the first 15 minutes. I don't like shaky cam. This movie reminds me a lot of another movie where heroes are fighting heroes this year, and I think this is pretty much the same. Of course, I like that one, too, so there you go. My podcasting life mate, Shag, wrote in to say, Tony was right about the Accords. Yep, sure, everyone has an agenda, but at the end of the day, the Accords were the right next step. Check yourself before someone else does. Black Widow actually had the best perspective of anyone in the film. As usual, I don't agree with Shag, but you can see where Tony's coming from. I think that's really one of the great things about that film's screenplay, is that you do see both sides. I was firmly Team Cap from the beginning, and I stayed that way, but it wasn't like I thought Iron Man was crazy or something, or, you know, they took over his brain or something nonsensical like that. I thought Tony made a lot of sense. Diablo Frank from the Rolled Spine podcast says, my boys and I already did a two-hour-plus podcast on this ourselves, but you guys managed to touch on so much stuff we missed that I guess the movie rated over 3 hours of total fanboy commentary. He also mentions, I listened to Ryan's threequel comment about 5 times in my car and understood what he was saying 0 times. Perhaps inspired by the physics in this movie, I'm reminded that the Resident Evil hexology of films were each and every one authored by none other than Paul W.S. Anderson, Esquire. But the first one is still the best slash worst, though the third one is better than the second. They're all better than the second one. I'll take your word for that, Frank. I have not seen any of those movies. Chuck Coletta comes back and he says, just caught the movie today, so I haven't listened to this episode yet. Overall, I enjoyed the film despite some reservations. One main flaw for me was that the film doesn't stand on its own, as Disney Marvel expects everyone in the audience to have seen nearly a dozen other films to fully grasp all the characters and context. The Marvel movies are more like episodic TV episodes than their own films. Yeah, I completely agree with that, Chuck, and I think that's by design. I really think that these movies are a live-action version of the Marvel Comics universe, and you can argue whether that's the right path to take. Some people argue that that isn't the right path to take in the comics. But they really are the Marvel Universe comic books writ large. It's sort of remarkable that they've been able to pull this off. But that, to me, that's what the movies are. You really do have to kind of know what's going on to really fully understand them. And I'm sure that leaves some people by the side of the road, and other people, they love it. Regarding episode 43, which was Kansas City Bomber with my pal Laura Make, Paul Hicks says, Rob, stop picking blockbusters. You're losing all credibility by focusing only on films that everyone saw and loved. Chris Franklin says, very fun episode. I'm now interested in watching the film and a roller derby bout. I didn't even know you called them that. Laura was very informative about the sport, and before this, I had no idea what the object of the game was other than women rolling at high speeds, hitting one another. It's essentially NASCAR without the cars. Who knew? Jeff Nettleton says, what I can recall of this film, Kansas City Bomber, was pretty good. Roller Derby turned up in some other areas, like an episode of The $6 Million Man, where Steve infiltrates a team that has been linked to the theft of government secrets. I want to say there was another TV show or two that did Roller Derby theme shows in the 70s. There is a 1950s roller derby movie with Mickey Rooney called The Fireball. It is based somewhat on the life of a real skater, though they played fast and loose with history. Rooney is an orphan who ends up becoming a skater, but eventually contracts polio. The plot of every movie in the 1950s. Mike Bridges says, cool, still waiting on a discussion for 1980s Flash Gordon. We'll get to that eventually, Mike. Calm down. Just enjoy Kansas City Bomber. David Ace Gutierrez, executive producer of Pod Dylan, says, Laura M. was a great addition to a blockbuster list of guests that really began with your Man Who Fell to Earth episode. Chuck Galetta, regarding my connection with Warner Archive, which was very kind enough to start sending us some movies. Susan Slept Here was the first one of those. He has some suggestions that we cover from the Warner Archive, Warner Archive, which is Going in Style, great movie. Dying Room Only, never heard of that one, but I love it for the title. And Cry Terror, that's a good one too. We'll love to get to them all. There's just only so many shows I can record in a week. The Irredeemable Shag comes back and says, listen today, what a great episode. Laura made a fantastic guest, and I learned something about the sport, too. Love it. Thank you. Yeah, I was really proud of that one. I really enjoyed having Laura on. She's one of my favorite people, and she did a great job. And I just, you know, it was like the perfect melding of, hey, there's a movie we can talk about, and can I have an expert to talk about the sport? Perfect. So I was really, really proud of that episode. I love Laura to death. Regarding episode 44, which was Susan Slept Here, Chris Franklin says, several years back, I remember explained to my son that the grandma in Disney Channel's Halloween Town series of movies was Princess Leia's mom. Mrs. Reynolds really has held up well. She still has that exuberant sparkle in her eyes. I call that star quality. Yeah, she was terrific in the Albert Brooks comedy Mother. Everyone knows how much I love Albert Brooks, and Mother is very funny, and she's tremendously funny in that movie, just giving Albert Brooks what for as his mom. So yeah, she's great. She's still with us. I would love to see her and Carrie Fisher like do something together. Because Carrie Fisher, I guess, is just going to be in Star Wars movies now, but I'd love to see them do a project, but we'll see. Jeff Nettleton writes in, he says, Les Tremaine, aside from Mentor, was known to me as Edward Quatermain on General Hospital during the big Luke and Laura era that included the whole James Bond riff they did with the Ice Princess and a weather machine. Yeah, that, I heard about that years, like decades ago, that like there was a whole plotline on General Hospital, including like a supervillain. I didn't know that like soap operas did that. I thought they were, like, I know that soap operas are soap operas with evil twins and mysterious deaths and, you know, so, but, like, I didn't know they did, like, supervillains. I didn't know they went, like, that crazy. I was like, what? Like, it just made no sense to me. He follows up with that Ewan McGregor Reese Witherspoon film is down with love, not down by love. Now, hold on, Jeff. It's Renee Zellweger, not Reese Witherspoon. So while I got the title wrong, you got the co-star wrong. So let's keep it straight. It is Down with Love, not Down by Love, because Down by Love is very similar to a Jim Jarmusch film, Down by Law, which has absolutely no connection to this movie. So my brain was all scrambled. Anyway, he says it's pretty good, though a little shaky at the start. It's aided greatly by David Hyde Pierce in the Tony Randall role and Tony Randall himself in a cameo. It's a real tribute to those Doris Day, Rock Hudson comedies. He says, Frank Tashlin directed my favorite Jerry Lewis films, The Geisha Boy and Who's Minding the Store, as well as another favorite romantic comedy, The Glass Bottom Boat, with Doris Day and Rod Taylor, as well as Arthur Godfrey, Paul Lynde, and Dick Martin. There's even a cameo of Robert Vaughn where the uncle music is heard. that's terrific. I love that. Paul Hicks also chimes in about the Down with Love. Again, it's Down with Love, not Down by Love. He mentions, of course, the director of that film was Peyton Reed, now known as the director of Ant-Man. So, yeah, good for him. That's going to do it for the feedback. I do want to thank everyone who retweeted or liked or retweeted and tweeted or whatever I do over on Twitter. So I'm going to go through that list very briefly. If there's any of you that I missed, my apologies. I'm still kind of new at collecting this whole feedback thing all by myself. Normally that's Shag's job over at Fire and Water. So at Film and Water, I'm still kind of playing catch up. So anyway, these are the people who retweeted the show. @NultiNC, Warner at Warner Archive. Thank you, Warner Archive. Dr. Ain 70. Reading_Hicks, Coffee Comics Blog, DSNRS, Pulp2Pixel, Commander Blanks, Abel Padzilla, JaceLab425, WFD Pod, Kyle Benning Art, Rolled Spine, David Gallagher, Garujo1, Xenozoic Files, tough to say, GBO26, Mark Gray, Warlord Worlds, BTP Blog, Black Harry Fan, DM Gutierrez, Radio vs. the Martians, Dangerous 2, Guano Man, and Trekker Talk. So thanks, everybody, for the feedback. I really, really appreciate it. And there was one more thing I want to get to in terms of the feedback is that we have a couple more iTunes reviews. So those are really, really appreciated. Let's get right to them. 5 stars from Piper Ruth. She says, you could sequester yourself in a bathroom stall at a local movie theater and listen to the ramblings of people that come in talking about movies that they just saw, but don't do that. That is more than a little weird and gross. Instead, listen to this great podcast from Rod Kelly and a guest of his choice where they give their takes on a given film that they have something profound to say about. This is a nice way to get insights you might not have had, and this is a fantastic way to dive deeper into the film. I haven't seen a lot of the movies, but now I want to so I can listen to the corresponding podcast. Thank you, Piper Ruth. Saya Masenko says 5 stars. Film and Water is just the best podcast for all movie buffs. You can revisit old favorites or discover new ones. These guys know their stuff, folks. Thank you very much, Saya. LTrig3 says, infectious listening, 5 stars. Join host Rob Kelly and his weekly guest as they bring their infectious love for a different movie each week. After listening to each podcast, I just want to stop and watch that movie. Their reviews cover everything from the classics to current releases. Perfect for any movie buff. Thank you so much, LTrig. And GB Blackrock says, do you like movies? ? Rob Kelly loves movies, and this podcast is his way of sharing that love with the world. He features various genres, so while each movie featured may not be to your specific taste, he nonetheless is something that should appeal to pretty much everyone. Thank you very much, GB, and thank you, everyone, for those reviews. That's really going to help as we talk about on all of our shows. iTunes reviews help get the show noticed, and, you know, there are 40 billion movie podcasts, so Film and Water is swimming against the tide of being noticed, so these reviews really, really help. And as always, for anyone who hasn't left a review yet, I implore you, please go to iTunes and leave the show a review. We would really, really appreciate it. Last thing before we sign off for this episode is I do want to talk about what we're going to be doing for the big canon celebration, what we're calling the Golden Globus Gala. As I mentioned in a couple episodes back, we're going to have a bunch of guests put together, and we're all going to do a sort of big smorgasbord of canon films. The original idea was to have all the segments in one episode, episode 50, but after recording the first 6 of 12 that were scheduled, I realized I had so much good content that putting 12 in one episode would just be too much. It would just be overload. And in the tradition of Menachem Golan, we're going to split it and make 2 shows. So the first 6 movies that I recorded from Golden Globus are going to be in episode 50, and that's coming just in a couple of weeks from now. And then I'm going to do a second set for another episode. I'm not sure exactly when that's going to come, but it's going to be a later episode, and that way everything has a little more room to breathe, because after recording the initial segments, I realized we have like over an hour's worth of content for just those six movies. I mean, I couldn't get David N. Gutierrez to shut up about The Apple, and I didn't want to edit him down. I just felt bad. I mean, he doesn't have a whole lot in his life. So I just figured this will be the best way. We get two episodes of Golan Globus fun. So that's going to be episode 50, so look forward to that. It'll be a whole lot of fun. So I guess that is going to do it for this episode of the Film and Water Podcast. I really appreciate Kevin Lauderdale coming by to talk about Meet Me in St. Louis. That was a lot of fun. He will definitely be back. If you want to leave a message for the show, you can go to the contact page over at our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com, or you can leave a comment on the individual show thread, or you can go to Twitter and follow the show at Film and Water Pod. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will see you soon. Bye.
And when I met her, she was, of all things, dragging him in to see the sorrow and the pity, which I counted as a personal triumph.